In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. In the 1960s, the post-war establishment on both sides of the Atlantic was challenged by a youth movement that questioned attitudes on everything from sexual liberation and racial equality to recreational drugs and the Vietnam War. The 60s was a tumultuous period in the West's modern cultural history, one that produced riots, protests, and some truly unforgettable music. For today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, Spencer Mizzen sat down with Alwyn Turner, senior lecturer in history at the University of Chichester, to delve into 60s counterculture.
Alwyn, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Alwyn, I'm going to start with a question that appears at the very top of the list of popular search engine queries. And that is, what was the 60s counterculture? Can you give us a brief introduction to this youth culture phenomenon?
I think the first place to start is, this is a term that was not used during the 1960s. It's a later coinage. It comes at the beginning of the 1970s, and so it's applied retrospectively to a phenomenon that is already on the wane. And therefore, there's not a really clear set of boundaries that were determined by the people who were active at the time. So to some extent, it's an amorphous term. It's part of, I guess, what was a worldwide phenomenon in the 1960s, a reaction against traditional authority, essentially. And that ranged from everything, right across the spectrum, from new theories on mental health through to new fashions in clothing. It could apply to anything. Within that big, broad movement, the counterculture is primarily about a tendency that is characterized by attitudes towards drugs, sex, music, communal living. There is and it emerges out of popular culture. So it's a part of a much larger thing, but it is associated primarily, when we talk about the counterculture, we're talking about hippies, about psychedelic music, about ideas of free love, that kind of thing.
Now, it's called the 60s counterculture. I mean, what is the date range of this phenomenon? I mean, are we talking 1960 to 1969, or is it harder to define than that?
I think it really becomes a very clear phenomenon by about 1964, 65. It's not there quite at the beginning, but it obviously grows out of what's already there. These things don't just emerge spontaneously. The roots are clear. I mean, right the way through the 1950s, you can see things. You can see it was 1954 that Aldous Huxley wrote his book, The Doors of Perception, about his experimenting on himself with mescaline. And that's where the American group The Doors took their name from in 10 years later. So there is an influence that comes through from the 1950s, from the beatnik culture that existed then, from things, movements like CND in Britain, civil rights in America. These things were already entrenched by the end of the 1950s, and they grow into what becomes the counterculture of the 60s.
Actually, can we explore that in a little bit more detail? Because my next question comes from someone describing themselves as the Golden from Golden on Instagram, and that is, how did 1950s culture shape and impact the 1960s counterculture? Now, I know we're going to talk about specific geopolitical events that drove the counterculture, such as the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement, a bit later on. But what was it about the makeup of post-war society that the counterculture was railing against?
I think you can go back even before the 50s, to be honest. I think it's the Second World War is such a seismic event, and it shows to many people that the established order right across the world has failed. It has presided over these two massive conflicts in the two world wars. Hundreds of millions of people are dead. We've seen the death camps in Germany. We've seen the use of the atomic bomb. There is a feeling that the way that the world has emerged, how it is organized, the power structures have lost all moral authority. They have failed. And so there's a rebellion against that. And it starts in fairly small terms. I mean, this is why the 1960s is what it's associated with, because that's when it becomes a mass movement. But there are, the tendencies are clearly there in the 1950s. The emergence of the beatniks are essentially a group of American writers, but calling for a kind of a return to an older version of America, a more primitive version before technology has become quite so destructive. That's an important part of what will become known as the counterculture, but it's already in place by the early and mid-1950s. So there is a very big hangover, no more than a hangover. It's an organic growth from that into what we call the counterculture.
And you spoke earlier about the rise of CND in Britain. I mean, how did that play into the rise of the counterculture?
CND was a very large movement. It tended to be a mostly educated middle-class movement, but it was associated with music. It associated itself with the trad jazz revival of the 1950s, to some extent with skiffle. So it was a political movement that was against all established parties, because of course it was the Labour Party that initiated Britain's atomic programme. Although it was a Conservative government by the time of CND. And so it's political, but it does have a cultural dimension. And I think that's important as well as in defining what the counterculture will become. It is that blend of politics and culture.
Sure. Now, here's a question from Hannah Laura Ridgely, which was also submitted on Instagram. And that is, where did the term hippie originate?
Well, that is a beatnik expression. Originally, it was hipster, as somebody who is very cool and switched on, and they were hipsters, and then that becomes transmuted down into hippies. So it is one of the kind of the concrete examples of how the 1950s shaped the 1960s. It is as I say, rooted in a 1950s cultural term.
Sure. If a single worldview or political aspiration united what we now call the hippies, I mean, what is it? Is it possible to define?
I guess it is. It's about that rejection of established authority and tradition. It's difficult to get much more specific than that because this is such an amorphous movement. It's so vague at times that there are elements of so many political creeds jumbled up in it. There's anarchy and there's liberalism, there's socialism, there's Maoism, there's black power in America, all jumbled up without any kind of coherent logic. And into that mix is also then thrown a heap of equally mixed up and jumbled fragments of religion, particularly of Eastern religion, bits of Hinduism and Buddhism, but not in any way that a conventional Hindu or Buddhist would understand or recognize. So the whole thing is this big melting pot of ideas, and people are taking whichever bits they want from that. It's a grab bag, to use another metaphor. People are just extracting elements, recombining them, and there is no great coherence to it, except that none of it relates to what it would be seen as the traditional Western values and systems.
Okay, another very popular query which is submitted on the internet search engines is, how did the Vietnam War influence the counterculture? So I wonder if you could answer that question and also maybe discuss some of the other significant political and social issues that really fired up young people in the 1960s.
The Vietnam War is absolutely central to this. The counterculture is primarily associated with America.
Yeah.
And America has conscription. And so young men know that they are going to be drafted to go and fight in this war, which is seen by this stage as an imperialist war, and imperialism is unfashionable and unacceptable because it is part of traditional thinking and convention, and because there is a personal risk. You know, you're going to be sent halfway around the world and you may well end up getting killed or seriously injured. There is a very definite existential threat to the individual. And so the campaign against Vietnam becomes the defining feature of 1960s counterculture, and wider than that. I mean, it takes in a whole range of elements that are beyond the counterculture. And it does inform it. In Britain, that makes much less sense, obviously, because in Britain we do not have an involvement in the Vietnam War. There are many people campaigning and arguing that the British government of Harold Wilson should take a more definite stand against Vietnam, but he does keep us out of the war, and so it's not as pressing. But it's still an issue in Britain in solidarity with America, and it is the kind of the battering ram of the counterculture that is used to attack a whole range of other institutions and established thinkings.
And what other issues were really energising people in this decade? And obviously, you had the civil rights movement as well. I imagine that was quite a large factor, wasn't it?
It is. I mean, largely because the civil rights movement had included so many volunteers, people going on voter registration drives in the south of America. It was an activist movement. It had drawn a lot of people in. It also expanded the range of black politics in America, so that the initiatives of Martin Luther King, which had dominated in the late 1950s and early 1960s, starts to splinter into black power movement, into the Nation of Islam, into the Black Panthers. Black people are becoming much more active, and they are not part of the counterculture, but associated with it. These things are working in parallels. That's the expression, and they are informing each other to a large extent.
The late 60s was marked by a series of a wave of protests and riots. I mean, can you talk us through the most significant of those, and to what extent were they driven by the counterculture?
I think what you can see with, if we take just a couple of examples, you can see the difference between America and Britain here. In America, in 1968, the biggest event probably is in political terms, is the demonstrations outside the Democratic Party convention in Chicago, which leads to massive police retaliation and the trial of what become known as the Chicago Eight, who are primarily hippies, but also include Bobby Seale, who is one of the leaders of the Black Panther Party. So there is that association is seen there. And it is a very, very political and very violent time. 1968 in America is also the year that Martin Luther King is assassinated, which sparks a wave of riots right across America, killing hundreds of people. I mean, these are really big, serious riots. In Britain, the biggest event of this kind of wave of demonstrations are a couple of demonstrations outside the American Embassy in Grosvenor Square in London, which again descend into some fighting between demonstrators and the police. But nobody is killed, and there are no big show trials afterwards. It is on a very different scale. And even that is sufficient that it drives away some of those who had been associated with the movement. So the Beatles famously write Revolution in response to the Grosvenor Square riots, and the Rolling Stones write Street Fighting Man. So both of which are distancing themselves from the violence. It is seen that even that has overstepped the mark. But it is so small by comparison with America. And I think that's a key difference here, that the counterculture is a term that is used to express different phenomena. They come from the same roots to some extent, but the stakes are just so much higher in America.
Particularly in America, how concerned was the establishment by the counterculture and by the phenomenon of young people turning on, tuning in and dropping out? Was this something that really, really was perceived as a threat by those in authority?
In America, certainly, because it is, again, as it goes back to Vietnam. If people are burning their draft cards and refusing to be drafted, and large numbers of people going north into Canada to escape the draft, this is a very real thing. If you cannot prosecute a war unless you have the support, however tacit, of the population. And people were turning against the Vietnam War, and it was a genuine threat to American foreign policy. In Britain, again, it's on a smaller scale, but there is a fear of this. And largely, I think, it's a fear of the unknown. It's okay with left movements who are claiming to be revolutionary socialists. We've known about those for a long time, and the establishment has ways of dealing with that and knows the size and the scale of the issue. The counterculture is much more difficult because it's new. And so there are big prosecutions of the underground press, magazines like Oz, the International Times. These are prosecuted, often on obscenity grounds, but clearly political. And there is an attempt to close these things down. And that would suggest a certain nervousness on the part of the authorities, that they don't really know what this is and how they're going to deal with it, but they fear that it might become something dangerous.
Sure. Now, my next question comes from Chaz Johnson 97, also on Instagram, and he wants to know if the counterculture was mainly the preserve of the affluent middle classes. And Marina, also on Instagram, wants to know, were countercultures concentrated in cities or were they found all over? So I guess I can kind of bundle these up into one question, and that kind of is, so how much reach did the counterculture have? And was it something that genuinely energised people from all strata of society?
I don't think there's any doubt that it starts as a middle-class phenomenon, and particularly with those amongst those with tertiary education. But even then, there's a certain subtlety to it. In Britain, it is more associated to start with the art schools than it is with the universities. And the art schools do tend to take a larger working class intake at this stage. And so it is about education as much as anything else, and education is largely a middle-class preserve. And it is certainly focused on cities, and not even all cities. I mean, in Britain, it is very definitely a London phenomenon for some time. But it does start to spread, and one of the ways that it spreads is through the culture. I mean, we use the expression counterculture, and the cultural bit is as important as the counter. The fact that the fact that music in particular, available universally, means that the message does spread, and it does start to move down the social scale a bit. In America, there is still there is a similar divide. Blue collar workers tend to be still going to serve in Vietnam. There is much less of a draft resistance amongst the working class in America. So it is, as many social and movements and revolutionary movements, it does start with those who have the time and the leisure to pursue alternative options.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Instead of it simply being, we must look after some poor, unfortunate, probably mentally ill men, it becomes, actually, this is an equally valid expression of sexuality, of humanity.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Now, you mentioned music there, and Nick Liz Sanders asks, what role did music play in spreading the new ideologies of this period? And Hannah May Sunshine asks, how important was music? So, yeah, can you expand on that a little bit, please?
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely essential. It is, without the music, it simply wouldn't have evolved in the same way or anywhere near to the same extent. It requires that. The fact that rock music has become the worldwide expression of youth culture by the mid-1960s, this is absolutely crucial to it. And particularly the Beatles are crucial to it. The Beatles embrace many of the trappings of the counterculture, and through them, that reaches people who would otherwise never have experienced it, because the Beatles are the biggest cultural event of the decade globally. Interestingly, though, the Beatles are not actually a particularly typical counterculture band. The music they play is not. And some of that is because they are essentially an art band. They have retired from live performance in 1966. And the counterculture is at its peak in 67, 68 to 69. And counterculture music primarily is about the live experience. It's about the idea that this is a music that unifies the performers on stage and the audience, and it is an interactive music. And it is seen, I guess, in Britain by groups like Pink Floyd with long improvised jams, and the equivalent in America with the Grateful Dead. The Beatles never do this. The Beatles don't do extended guitar solos, let alone jam sessions that last for half an hour. They are an art band, but they are big enough that if they say the counterculture is all right, then it's all right. And I think the music, apart from that element of promoting and spreading the message, it's about the communality of it. It's about the unifying force. This is the one thing that everybody can agree on. In that big jumble of ideas that ranges from saying the Chairman Mao has the answers to everything through to people who are interested in Hindu ideas of reincarnation, the one thing you can come together on is rock music. That is... Along with Vietnam, that is what unifies the entire movement.
What about drugs? What influence did the wider availability of recreational drugs have on the movement?
It shapes it entirely. Initially, the prevalence of cannabis, but most particularly the emergence of hallucinogenics with the availability of LSD. And it's about experimentation. This is still a phrase that we use now. Particularly politicians who experimented with drugs when they were at university. You think there's not a great deal of experimenting going on there. You knew what it was about. It's recreational. But there was a genuine sense of experimentation. I mentioned Aldous Huxley earlier in the 1950s, who was consciously using mescaline to see what it did to his brain, how it affected his perceptions of the world. That is very definitely a part of this. It is not simply a recreational use, although obviously that is a big bit of it. It is also the idea that this is what changes our views of what is important in life. And it will open up new vistas, new ideas, and it will take us into new directions. And if you're rebelling against tradition, then you want new experiences, you want new ways of seeing things. And so it has a, there's an almost evangelical nature to it, particularly in 64, 65 in America, when Timothy Leary is advocating the use of hallucinogenic drugs. This is integral to the counterculture, and it's separated to some extent from the political versions that were existing at the time.
Can you just talk about Timothy Leary for a little bit, please? Because he's a name that comes up quite often when you're looking into the counterculture. I mean, was he genuinely one of its leaders?
Yes, undoubtedly. And one of the philosophers of it, if that's not too grand a term, and it probably isn't. He does seriously believe that the use of psychedelic drugs, hallucinogenic drugs, will change the nature of society and in a positive direction. That it allows our brains to perceive more than we can do in normal states of being.
Yeah.
And that is, as I say, it is evangelical. There is a belief that this is a new humanity that can emerge from this. And there were, you know, jokes about spiking the American water supply with acid. That was intended as a serious concept, not the action, but the idea that it was possible to change how we structured society, and that we would be better if we used more drugs.
Okay, we've very much talked about America and the UK so far. But Luke Gaulchy wants to know, did hippie culture affect other parts of the West? And actually, can I add another question to that? I mean, did it cross the Berlin Wall? Did it in any way play into, for example, the Prague Spring?
The counterculture is essentially, from how we perceive it, is about America and Britain, but it is right across Europe. Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Berlin, West Berlin are big centres of counterculture as well. They all take different forms in the same way that Britain is the British version is different to the American. Everything takes a certain national form because of different cultural traditions feeding into it. But it is a worldwide phenomenon, or at least a Western worldwide phenomenon. It is seen to some extent in Central America and even into South America, although most South America at this stage is comprised of fairly repressive regimes. And that, of course, is also true behind the Iron Curtain. You mentioned the Prague Spring. Czechoslovakia is the one place where it is seen most. But even then, it is very small. It is small pockets of people. They are receiving it, again, largely through the music, because you can pick up Western radio. Czechoslovakia is near enough to Western Europe to pick up radio stations. Apart from the propaganda stations of the West, normal radio broadcasting is available. The music is heard. The inspiration is there. There are people who wish to be affected by it, but it is relatively easy to crush. There is a campaign in Czechoslovakia where the state is enforcing the cutting of hair. Long hair on men has become the great symbol of the counterculture, and that's relatively easily dealt with by getting the police to take you off to a barber and get your hair cut. So It is a factor in Czechoslovakia. You can see it with Václav Havel's embrace of 1960s music, particularly the Velvet Underground and Lou Reed. But it's not a big force within that. And the Prague Spring is not really generated by the counterculture so much as an awareness that there are things from the West that are positive. But I think it's above the level of counterculture.
Would you say there was a dark side to the counterculture? I mean, just a like one example you've got, Charles Manson. I mean, would you say he was a product of the counterculture? And if so, so to what extent did his activities act as a real reputational damage on the movement?
Yes, he is part of the counterculture. He runs a commune in the desert in California, which is very much a countercultural concept, that idea of communal living and of having a guru. And he is a guru. He's older than most of these. This is absolutely crucial to the counterculture. It's about youth. Manson is not young. He's been around a long while. He's been in jail a long time, but he's an older man. And part of the problem with the counterculture is there is an element of it that is captured in the slogan peace and love, which is essentially naive. It assumes that everyone is going to share in your utopian dream. But it does also leave one open to exploitation by those who aren't very nice. And Charles Manson was not. And he is arrested in December 1969, which seems kind of symbolic because the 60s are aware, as the decade comes to the close, the 60s are aware that they are a decade. This is a thing. There is a 1960s. And the idea that it ends the last month of the decade sees the arrest of Charles Manson, who will be charged with multiple murders and who has come out of this world. And he has associations with the music of the time. He's worked with members of the Beach Boys, for example. He's kind of mixed up in the music world of the time. That seems to me massively symbolic and was seen at the time as being symbolic. And the other thing in December 1969, to round off the decade on a bad note, is the Rolling Stones concert at Altamont in California, where they have decided that they should employ the Hells Angels as security. They'd used the Hells Angels as security when they played in Hyde Park in London, but the British Hells Angels are a very different beast to the American Hells Angels at this stage, and the American Hells Angels are they're effectively a form of organised crime. They are a kind of underground mafia, but because they seem to be rebels, and they seem to be part of youth culture, they are associated with the counterculture, and they are seen as being fashionable. So the Rolling Stones, who wish to be fashionable, employ them as security guards. There is extreme violence, people are killed, and it is the most notorious concert in rock and roll history. And again, as I say, it's December 1969. It feels like the decade is ending on the most bleak negative note possible, and it has come from within the counterculture, from within youth culture.
So was there kind of a recognition even at the time that it was coming to an end, and coming to an end with the end of the decade?
Yes, I think so. It had started to go wrong the previous year, really. 1968 had shown the limits of where the counterculture and the wider movement beyond that, how the limits of how far it was going to get. Because this is essentially a youth explosion, young people are still in a minority. And 1968 saw an older majority decide to reject this world. So most famously in Europe in 1968, there is the Great Paris Uprising, where there's a general strike. Workers and students seem to be united, and they are coming together. And this is one of the most serious challenges to a capitalist state in Western Europe there's ever been. Shortly afterwards, there are elections to the French Parliament, and General de Gaulle's party, the right-wing party, wins an absolute landslide. The Prague Spring that you mentioned earlier, that is crushed. In Britain, we have probably the biggest political event in mainstream politics is Enoch Powell making his Rivers of Blood speech, which attracts a huge amount of support from the public. In America, Bobby Kennedy is murdered in America, who is the great liberal hope. And Richard Nixon, the most right-wing president since the war, is elected as president. There is a sense of a counter-revolution against the counterculture. And so it has hit the buffers to some extent.
Okay, so N. Koss, writing on Instagram, wants to know, what did the counterculture achieve? So, I mean, how successfully did it alter the trajectory of late 20th century societies and change people's attitudes to, for example, gender equality and sexual liberation?
I think it has an important role to play. Although I was just saying it kind of hits the buffers and it is suppressed to some extent, it does have a long legacy and it has shaped attitudes. If you take homosexuality, male homosexuality has been an issue in Britain, a political issue since the 1950s with the Wolfenden Report, the idea that this should be legalised or at least decriminalised. That was going to come to fruition anyway, and it does. In the late 1960s, under the government of Harold Wilson, male homosexuality is decriminalised. That would have happened with or without the youth culture explosion that was going on around it. What changes it, I think, is attitudes towards what homosexuality means. That this is, from those who were enacting that law, introducing that law, rather, in Parliament, it is, homosexuality is an unfortunate condition and we shouldn't oppress those who are afflicted by it. The counterculture, largely through the pages of the underground press of Oz and IT, is much more positive. It is an embrace of and a celebration of gay culture, gay lifestyles. And so it changes the nature of this reform. Instead of it simply being, we must look after some poor, unfortunate, probably mentally ill men, it becomes, actually, this is an equally valid expression of sexuality, of humanity. And so I think that's the bit that changes, I think. And that takes a while to feed through. And to some extent, that's because it's generational. This is coming from youth. But it does have a huge long-term impact. And it does make possible things. And it is noticeable that the gay liberation movement in Britain adopts the form of the counterculture. It sets up Gay News, which is very, very definitely and deliberately in the lineage of Oz and International Times. It is an alternative underground newspaper. It is intended in that tradition. So there is a legacy to it there, I think. It does change attitudes. And, yeah, so the same is true of sexual equality, of race, of the environment, as very, very importantly. I mean, environmentalism is starting to take off in the late 1960s, and obviously it is driven by scientists, but they are finding very few places in the orthodox media who are prepared to listen to what they are saying. The underground press are lapping it up, and they are propagating the message. And so they may not be initiating any of these great changes, but they are the conduit for how this stuff is spread.
I mean, is part of the challenge of any counterculture movement and youth movement the fact that people grow older and then gradually get more conservative as they age?
That is a function of humanity, I guess, isn't it? When you have the mortgage and you have family commitments and you have to get up in the morning to go to work, things start to look different. Beyond that, beyond the trappings of it, there is a change in attitude. When one is young, one is more open to ideas, and more willing to experiment with alternative viewpoints. And to some extent, yes, it was going to come to an end, I guess. And the 1970s were a very different feel. And a new generation emerges that is very different. By the time you get onto the glam rock generation of 1973-74, there is a conscious rejection of politics, whereas half a generation earlier, rock music was all about the politics.
And finally, Arwen, I want to end with a question from somebody calling themselves a Possumator on Instagram. What long-term effects of the counterculture can we still see today? If in Britain in 2022, is there a counterculture still out there? And to what extent was that impacted by what went on in the 1960s?
It has become diffused into the mainstream culture, so that it is very difficult to tell sometimes where it is, because it has become, to use the cliche of our times, the new normal. But there is clearly a massive legacy. Germaine Greer came out of the underground press, and her influence on the feminist revolution has been the biggest change in our culture in the last 50 years. I think you can see it in America with the wave of computer entrepreneurs. The whole ethos of Apple is rooted essentially in the counterculture, and the idea of new ways of doing things that has emerged from it. The environmentalism is important. The fact that we now have such a growing movement towards vegetarianism and veganism, that is very much part of the counterculture legacy. It has just permeated into things. It is a genuine revolution, I think. And although it doesn't achieve what it intended to in the immediate term, as people slightly foolishly and optimistically hoped at the time, that does not negate the fact that it had this long-term impact. And it took 50 years for it fully to change the world, but we do now see things in very different ways, and a lot of that is because of what happened in the late 1960s.
That was Alwyn Turner, Senior Lecturer in History at the University of Chichester. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.